Hi everyone, welcome back to ISGP's The Forum, where science comes to socialize. If you're not familiar with us by now, well, we're the podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. We are a three-person team on air with you. My name's Aubrey, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, the usual suspects, Cleo and Daniela.
Thanks for the customary introductions, Aubrey. I'm Cleo, and it's my job to remind you that we encourage you to interact with us on social media. You'll find the forum on Twitter at twitter.com/ISGPforum and on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPforum. Not to brag or anything, but we're pretty good at responding to your messages really quickly.
Yeah, not sure if that's a testament to our diligence or social media's social dominance, but a fact's a fact. Hit us up.
So what's the topic of conversation today?
Well, plants, if you want the short answer.
What's the long answer?
More specifically, we'll talk about development of perennial crops to advance sustainable agriculture goals.
That's different.
That's niche.
Oh, totally. But it really is only fitting considering we spend every few episodes discussing different strategies for ensuring the long-term viability of our food supply. Well, here we have another.
That's fair enough. All right, so if we're talking perennial plants, then my guess is that we're discussing the policy position paper written by Dr. Lee DeHaan from the Land Institute in Kansas.
Wait, this is from ISGP's conference at Eckerd College. Aubrey, this is the first time I met you.
And now you wish you never had.
Well, only once every few weeks.
Hey. Wow, I feel the love. You were supposed to totally disagree with me. But anyway, yes, Dr. DeHaan defended his paper called Perennial Crops Are a Key to Sustainably Productive Agriculture at the Production and Sustainability ISGP conference held in 2015.
His paper can be accessed at the ISGP's website, scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Or you could do the more fun option and just listen to the rest of this episode, which we'll use to boil down the major plot points for you.
All right, time for some context, which I'll give by putting my co-host on the spot, Daniela.
This is because I was late to our recording session, isn't it?
I can neither confirm nor deny. Anyway, Daniela, when's the last time you ate bread?
Does a sandwich count? I had a sandwich for lunch today. Oh, right. And then toast with breakfast earlier?
That actually reminds me that I need to go grocery shopping because I'm almost out of bagels.
Bagels! That was my breakfast yesterday. So clutch when you're on the go, you know?
Thanks kindly for proving my point without even knowing it. Daniela and Cleo have really demonstrated for us a perfect example of just how crucial grain products have become to our food system, whether for nutrition purposes or just for taste.
Or, if you're me, they sometimes feel crucial to your very existence.
Or at least to the well-being of the people around you. I've seen you hangry, Cleo, and it is not pretty.
Oh, yeah, me too. At conferences, I've been tempted to carry around emergency muffins for you. But either way, during the debate, it was mentioned that nearly 75% of U.S. land is devoted to the growth of annual grain crops, and that over 70% of food calories consumed by people actually come from grains.
Yep, that pretty much sums up my diet.
Oh, just wait till you start grad school. Anyway, the grain systems that make this sort of consumption pattern possible are actually causing a good deal of concern when it comes to sustainability, both on and off the farm.
One of those concerns has to do with agricultural land itself. On 80% of the world's cropland, soil erosion is considered moderate to severe. Erosion, of course, is soil loss. So it's pretty easy to see how this is worrisome. Because of soil erosion, 10 million hectares of agricultural land are abandoned each and every year.
And when you have these soil problems that force you to abandon your cropland, you then have to start cultivating wildland or forest areas just to maintain your food supply. This is obviously a huge problem on the conservation and biodiversity side of things.
Then there are problems like nutrient leaching. What I mean here, of course, is that agriculture uses fertilizers, and those fertilizers contain elements like nitrogen and phosphorus, which, when they're washed away from the fields following rain or something, end up contaminating surface or groundwater supplies. The contaminated water becomes damaging to the ecosystem, and it can also be undrinkable if expensive water treatments aren't performed.
And to further complicate matters, a growing global population, paired with overall increases in worldwide affluence, means that the worldwide demand for grain-related products in, say, the year 2050 will be more than double the demand we saw back in 2005. So you could imagine these problems we just mentioned really being exacerbated in the future.
Which is why ecological intensification has been proposed as a solution.
Ecological intensification basically involves paying attention to environmental principles and understanding the ecology of the land that you're working with to achieve greater productivity while protecting the soil and minimizing other impacts.
And this is where Dr. DeHaan's interest in perennial crops really comes into play, because annual crops, as agreed by our debaters, facilitate soil degradation. Now, if you're not a green-thumbed gardener, a perennial plant is one that lives for several years instead of dying and needing to be replanted after one season. The latter description is characteristic of annuals. Perennial crops would be a contributor to ecological intensification because these plants use more of the available sunlight and water to potentially reach higher yields, plus they can help protect the soil.
The debaters all agreed that perennials have other benefits too.
Totally. The other ones they mentioned include the fact that you can usually harvest multiple times per year, and perennials typically require fewer resource inputs.
And they often exhibit greater resilience to extreme weather conditions. Shout out to all of our past episodes on severe storms, climate variability, and wildfires. Claps for being relevant.
Now, the question is, are we taking advantage of these possible benefits of perennial crops? And the answer is, well, sort of. Or we're trying to, or we are, but for a different purpose, or.
Or the perennial crop market, if you will, has been limited to biofuels.
Yeah, okay, I was trying to get there.
Yeah, sure you were, Dee. But we'll go into this a little further because it's a bit complex. So, are we all familiar with what biofuels are? Just in case. Basically, as a possible alternative energy strategy, scientists are exploring ways of turning plants and algae into liquid fuels, and those are called biofuels. But according to Dr. DeHaan, biofuel strategies are trying to help with alternative energy goals, but they're creating sustainability problems in the process.
Right. Essentially, there are three main categories of biofuel projects at present, and each poses its own concerns. First off, there's the option of creating biofuels from annual grain crops. Now, you may say, wait, I thought we wanted to eat that stuff. And you'd be kind of right. This type of biofuel project has generally been supported by policy, and the net gains have been relatively poor because you have crazy soil degradation, increased food costs since we're turning possible food into fuel, and poor energy return.
Yeah, that sounds like the short end of the stick there. But unfortunately, the other two categories aren't significantly better. Dr. DeHaan explained that the second biofuel category here involves using residues of plants after the grain has been harvested and turning those residues into fuels. Plant residues are basically just parts of the plant we don't eat, by the way.
Sounds less wasteful, sure, but still slightly problematic. While we do avoid using foods that could be, eaten for fuel sources, we have the possibility of incurring major environmental damage. Residues being pulled from the ground, it's not hard to imagine how this could encourage some serious soil erosion. Once all of those roots and stems and whatnot are taken from the ground, there's not much left holding that soil in place and keeping it from just blowing away.
Now, for the last biofuel category, perennial plants grown exclusively for biofuel production. These plants can include grasses and trees that help protect soil, suck up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and even provide habitat to wildlife. So, where's the problem? Well, dedicating land to growing perennial biofuel crops takes away cropland from growing food. This seems like some weird cycle where addressing one problem brings you right back into another.
Yeah, and here's a fun fact. Did you know that most of the corn grown in western Kansas is actually used for ethanol production rather than food? It's a case in point, really.
And Dr. DeHaan thinks we need a major paradigm shift when it comes to perennial plants and land usage. According to his position paper, recent advances in genetics and plant breeding have made possible the development of new crops, largely herbaceous perennials like rice, wheat, and sorghum, which are capable of providing direct food for humans in the form of grain. And that was mostly quoted from his paper.
These crops are expected to provide some of the ecosystem services, aka environmental benefits, that in turn help out humans, that we've already indirectly mentioned today. Things like carbon sequestration, provision of clean water, improved soil quality, and wildlife habitat.
And debaters seem to agree that the public sector should support perennial food crop development that simultaneously offers these ecosystem services.
Yeah, they actually discussed an existing perennial crop example that demonstrates the benefits that these sort of crops can provide. The crop is called intermediate wheat, and it actually grows faster and doesn't require any complicated harvesting techniques that are different from typical wheat variants.
The entire above the ground portion of the intermediate wheat plant can be harvested for food, while the root system, which actually makes up a bulk of the biomass, remains underground, enhancing soil quality and holding the soil in place.
Well, then there's also perennial rice being developed in China, which allows for higher rice yields in regions with drier climates than annual varieties.
And it's not like planting these perennial food crops would put biofuels out of practice. Actually, not at all. We can use the residues of these plants each year to make biofuels. So we'd essentially be simultaneously producing food and fuel in these fields. Now that's the multitasking I can get on board with.
Okay, so not to change the subject, but you know as well as I do, Danielle, that multitasking is literally the name of the game for the three of us. Podcasting, yeah, not a full-time job, people, though it could be if we let
Okay, anyway, good idea, but here's my next question. Presumably, this perennial wheat or rice or whatever is exciting because wheat and rice are normally annual crops. So, how are we turning them perennial?
And that's a great question. It turns out that the technique isn't as simple as taking good old wheat and flipping a switch to make it live longer. Instead, the one option is to actually take wild varieties of these perennial grain-producing plants and domesticate them.
Okay, so we're taking wolves and turning them into dogs, but on a plant scale. I get the concept, but if I remember anything from middle school social studies classes discussing the origins of civilization, it's that domesticating things, whether corn or a dog, takes a super long time.
Well, in your middle school classes, you were talking about centuries worth of time. But today, we have access to modern breeding and genetic techniques that quite literally slash the amount of time that it takes to domesticate a wild rice variety, for instance.
Right. When we domesticate a plant, we want to get rid of less than ideal traits like small seed size or seed toxicity, as I'm sure you might imagine how that one could be problematic. So in this case, we identify a wild perennial plant of interest, then we introduce mutations or these gene editing techniques to say, make the plant seed not kill you.
This whole process, in fancy terminology, is called de novo domestication, or quite literally, new domestication.
Are there other options for achieving food-producing perennials?
Well, another option mentioned by Dr. Dahan is called wide hybridization. In this case, scientists take a domesticated crop and cross it with its wild perennial relative. The hope here is that the resulting plant will retain the positive domesticated traits of the annual crop while adopting the perennial nature of the wild relative. But we have to worry about the spawn being sterile. We also have to accept the fact that conserving only the desired traits from each parent is beyond difficult.
Yes, and I could definitely have a few stories about children not getting desired traits from each parent right away, but those are stories from the preschool I work at for another time.
All right. I guess the take home is, whichever way it's accomplished, turning wild perennials into domesticated variants for food purposes in a reasonable time frame is feasible now, thanks to genetic technologies. The question remains, though, with biofuels as the current target for perennialization, I totally just made that word up, but where do we the question remains, where do we stand with developing agricultural perennials?
Well, we've already mentioned a couple.
Yeah, rice, wheat, sorghum, but I hardly think that means we've reached capacity with our technology here.
I guess to address this point, Dr. Dehan called on the government to support research on perennials that can provide human food first and biofuels in the form of plant residues second.
So, what kind of research are we talking about, though? It kind of sounds like we already know how to perform the domestication and all. Are we talking mostly development at this point, then?
Not quite. Full disclosure, perennials have some downsides too. At present, perennial crop yields tend to decrease each time the plants reproduce, and stress conditions such as drought can halt reproduction.
Hold up. Hey. Do you know that song? Okay, wait a sec. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Because I'm not thinking about the song.
Almost definitely. I thought we said that perennial plants can survive better in climate-constrained situations, but now you're saying that drought can stop them from reproducing?
Well, no, think of it this way. The perennial plants can typically survive the high stress situation, but they do so while producing less seeds. Annual plants will keep producing seeds at their normal pace, so to speak, but then they'll effectively succumb to and die because of the stressor.
Got it. Okay, continue with your downsides to perennials.
Well, I was just going to say that perennial seeds are expected to cost more than the seeds of annuals. I'd imagine all these issues could be active research areas anyway.
Yeah, research could definitely help us improve perennial crop yields, optimize harvesting practices, and figure out the most effective ways to incorporate these new crops into agricultural systems, like modifying crop rotation patterns, which we'll talk about in about another minute.
And still in the R&D sense, but focused on biofuels, Dr. DeHaan believed that both current and yet-to-be-debuted biofuels should be evaluated based on their ability to provide substantial energy while still not degrading the ecosystem via, say, a net increase in greenhouse gas emissions or depletion of natural resources or something like that.
You're right. And looking back at his paper, he's not just calling on one nation's government, or even just federal government for that matter, to take this approach to prioritization of food-providing perennials.
Why is it that you keep getting to say all of these things with major amounts of alliteration?
I don't know. Aubrey outlined this episode and she loves her alliteration, so I blame her.
All right, I'll be sure to keep that in mind for next episode. Or maybe I'll give you even harder things to say.
All right, I'm usually the one who has to say all the weird science words that I can't pronounce. But anyway, let's get back on track here. Danielle is right. Dr. DeHaan mentioned that all agricultural research funders, spanning international, federal, and state levels, should be facilitating the production of crops that A, are edible, and B, provide ecosystem services.
Actually, the debaters discussed how U.S. states have crop improvement associations, whose jobs are actually to distribute seeds to farmers. So, at the state level anyway, the debaters saw these groups as perfectly poised actors to produce and distribute perennial seeds.
And it was clear that on a more local, in the field level, Dr. DeHaan supported the idea of incorporating perennials into cropland rotation schedules. He mentioned this in the context of Florida, since, of course, this conference took place in the Sunshine State, and so he referenced work done by David Wright at the University of Florida.
Which has shown that crop rotations incorporating sod, so grass that obviously can live for several years, well, these rotations are ultimately more profitable than annual crop rotations.
And since not everyone listening in is necessarily accustomed to farm life and vernacular, crop rotation is basically a practice which involves switching which crops are grown on patches of land in differing growing seasons. Usually it's done so that the soil can be replenished of essential nutrients.
But when it comes to developing perennials, we return to the point that we'd likely benefit from not just perennial wheat, rice, and sorghum, but other crops as well.
As it turns out, perennial crops already in production are typically of the nut and fruit variety. I mean, think about it. You don't replant an apple orchard every year. So, debaters suggested that the production of perennial commodity crops like nuts and fruits needs to expand in the food system.
Which is easier said than done, to be honest. This very action item is somewhat biologically disincentivized by the fact that tree-based crops take several years to produce any amount of harvestable product. Using Aubrey's example, when you plant an apple tree, you're not going to get apples for at least a year, or maybe even a few more.
It's also worth noting that perennial crops, especially green crops, actually can't grow everywhere. Take Florida, once again, as an example.
As our seasoned Floridians Cleo and Daniela know, Florida's temperature is relatively constant throughout the year, and there's definitely no cold winter. While perennial crops rely on these sorts of seasonal changes to effectively know when to flower, so annual varieties will typically flourish here.
Debaters did mention that perennial sorghum should be applicable to Florida, though, because it originates in the perpetually warm regions of Africa.
Doesn't change the fact that in general, perennials cannot be universally grown, at least not the kinds of perennials we're dealing with presently.
True, and all in all, it was agreed that perennial crop growth wouldn't put annual crops out of business, so to speak. Plus, perennial crops typically won't be considered economically advantageous for farmers until the perennials themselves reach a certain milestone. Namely, they've got to produce 1,000 pounds of harvest per acre of growth.
That sounds lofty.
Sounds practical, honestly.
Well, I guess that's fair. So, do you both think we've covered everything from the debate?
Actually, yeah, I think those were the major plot points. In summary, Dr. DeHaan and our debaters seem to agree that perennial crops offer opportunities to simultaneously produce food, generate biofuels, and provide ecosystem services. All joking aside, they're kind of a triple threat.
But there are still drawbacks keeping perennials from being widely adopted as crops. What research areas do you think need to be prioritized to put these crop variants into agricultural practice?
Feel free to answer this question and ask any of your own on social media.
You'll find us on Twitter at ISGP Forum and on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGP Forum.
As always, tag your posts with hashtag ISGP Forum so other listeners can find your comments.
Well, I think that just about wraps things up for today. On behalf of Cleo, Daniela, and myself, as well as the rest of the staff at the Institute on Science for Global Policy, thanks for choosing to socialize with science, and we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.